Chapter 16. Open Season. President Putin and the Russian security services operate like a super PAC. Fiona Hill. By the time Trump entered the White House, Ihor Kolomoisky was on the run. Even with his personal militia, even with his power base carved out of central Ukraine, the investigations into Kolomoisky's steering of Privatbank and the $5.5 billion hold that authorities discovered, sending them scrambling to nationalize the bank, proved too hot for the oligarch-turned-warlord. He skipped first to Switzerland, holing up in Geneva, and then hopped to Tel Aviv, where he enjoyed Israeli citizenship. Popular revulsion against the oligarch began brewing in Ukraine proper. The one-time patriot had morphed, in the span of only a few months, into a kind of synecdoche for the entire corrupt roster of oligarchs still running the country. Kolomoisky the hero had transformed into Kolomoisky the warlord, Kolomoisky the scapegoat, Kolomoisky the enemy. It was a role the oligarch appeared happy to embrace. Outside Ukraine, Kolomoisky began lobbing public calls for Ukraine to default on much-needed loans from the International Monetary Fund, IMF, claiming Kyiv could stand on its own and that it didn't need any Western financial support, coming as it did with demands for domestic transparency and anti-corruption reforms. The IMF just so happened to be demanding that Kolomoisky never return to a leadership position at Privatbank, for instance. The oligarch also abruptly began flipping his rhetoric about Russia. In an interview with the New York Times, Kolomoisky sounded like a leopard who'd changed his spots, calling for Kyiv to rebuild ties with the country that had invaded and decimated Ukraine's eastern and southern flanks. "Give it 5, 10 years, and the blood will be forgotten," Kolomoisky said. And if the U.S. or the IMF kept pushing anti-corruption reforms, or if they get smart with us, we'll go to Russia. As Kolomoisky added, Moscow was stronger anyway. Russian tanks will be stationed near Poland. Your NATO will be soiling its pants and buying Pampers. Nor was this all bluster. Back in Kyiv, Valeria Gontareva, who'd led the investigation into Privatbank, started discovering threatening messages around her home. One day, there was a piece of graffiti on a wall outside her house calling her a Russian pig. Another tag sprayed the word killer with dollar signs scribbled around. Her home itself was vandalized. And then, one morning, she encountered a piece of Kolomoisky's threat portfolio that his rivals had once experienced, an open coffin containing an effigy of Gontareva clad in black and white stripes, a black bouquet placed near her feet, sitting outside the doors of the Ukrainian Central Bank, waiting for her to arrive to work. No one claimed responsibility for the threats, nor for the effigy, nor for the sudden upsurge in pressure to get her to pull back from the investigations into certain oligarchs looting Ukrainian depositors and cycling their dirty money through the U.S. But Gontareva, who outlasted a number of post-revolution finance ministers who couldn't handle the stress, had her suspicions. "I'm like the Fenimore Cooper novel, Last of the Mohicans," she said. "I was called a killer of oligarchs." Soon, though, the threats metastasized. In London, where Gontareva is now living, a car ran directly into her, sending her to the hospital. Just a few weeks later, her home in Ukraine burned to the ground. Investigations into both proved inconclusive, but it wasn't too much to imagine that a man she'd outed for allegedly running one of the world's greatest Ponzi schemes might be involved. All the while, an entire buffet of cases regarding Kolomoisky's alleged swindle continued. Lawsuits laying out Kolomoisky and the Optima family's use of American assets to launder their ill-gotten gains burst forth in the U.S., from former partners and Privatbank's new owners alike. In Ukraine, lawsuits fingered the laundering operations, with legal filings even popping up in places like the U.K. Kolomoisky denied any allegations of impropriety, and counterpunched by demanding control of the bank once more. These suits and countersuits all took place while the details of the alleged swindle continued to leak out, leaving battered and beleaguered Ukrainians watching from the sidelines. Kolomoisky, though, spied a potential out. The post-revolution administration of Petro Poroshenko began faltering, growing increasingly unpopular as Ukraine's economic heaves and inability to dislodge Russia became more pronounced. By early 2019, a new challenger rose to unseat him. Volodymyr Zelensky, a cherubic, 40-year-old comedian, had no prior political experience, no previous attachment to any administrations or previous regimes. Instead, He had something Ukrainian politicos had long lacked: charisma. He knew how to work audiences. He knew how to charm voters who'd watched him play a Ukrainian president on television for years. And come April, Zelensky, who'd pledged greater Western engagement, proved that he knew how to do something else: win a presidential election, and do so in a landslide. The comedian routed the oligarch in that year's election, taking nearly 75% of the vote over Poroshenko. Instantly, Ukraine's pro-Western, pro-reform agenda appeared assured. Zelensky promised change and transparency and fealty to voters rather than to the oligarchic class that had long gutted the country. Ukraine, nearly three decades after the Soviet collapse, finally appeared on the right footing. But there was one catch. Zelensky himself may not have been an oligarch, and he may not have been involved in any of those previous schemes to loot the country's coffers, but there was one oligarch who appeared in Zelensky's shadow, peeking out from behind the new president. Zelensky's television show, the one where he'd posed as a Ukrainian president, appeared on a Ukrainian television channel that happened to be part of a series of oligarchic holdings. The channel that hosted Zelensky's show, that paid his bills, that reached his audiences, that launched Zelensky directly into the presidency, was owned by none other than Kolomoisky. And maybe it was time for Kolomoisky to capitalize on that relationship with this new doe-eyed president. Zelensky never denied the fact that Kolomoisky owned the channel on which the youthful new president had appeared, or that the two had been, by all indications, close. But the new president could read the electorate. "We must do everything we can so that the previous owners of Privatbank do not get a single kopeck," Zelensky announced, singling out his former patron. "It's impossible to influence me. Neither Kolomoisky nor any other oligarch. No one will influence me." Zelensky had put his foot down. Kolomoisky would have no sway over his new administration. The oligarch quickly put the president's claims to the test. In 2019, shortly after Zelensky's election, Kolomoisky returned to Ukraine. He apparently felt comfortable enough to oversee his legal fight from the belly of Kyiv, showing Ukrainians and the country's Western financial backers in the IMF and in Washington that he wouldn't be cowed. Not by investigators, and certainly not by a president he helped launch to power. "If I put on glasses and look at myself like the whole rest of the world, I see myself as a monster, as a puppet master, as the master of Zelensky, someone making apocalyptic plans," Kolomoisky leered. "I can start making this real." He'd become, as one later analyst said, a man in a class of his own, a super oligarch, dedicated to making his will known to both the new president and the rest of Ukraine alike. But early indications backed up Zelensky's claims of independence from his former backer. Zelensky held his ground. A year into the new president's administration, Ukraine's parliament pushed through legislation that formally blocked the oligarch from ever regaining control of Privatbank, known, memorably enough, as the Anti-Kolomoisky Law. Politically, it will mean in the eyes of the general public and political elites that he has lost control over Zelensky, which is a real blow. Tatiana Shevchuk, who works as a lawyer with the country's Anti-Corruption Action Center, said. And Shevchuk was right. Suddenly, Kolomoisky's path back to his assets and to his power base appeared stunted, closed on all fronts. Despite his return, his standing in Ukraine had collapsed. His legal bills piled up in Ukraine and the U.S. and elsewhere, and the new president hardly appeared to be in his pocket. For the sinking oligarch, though, Kolomoisky had one card left up his sleeve, a Trump card, fittingly enough, still left to play. And by early 2020, Kolomoisky saw his chance. While Trump decimated America's anti-corruption platform, his administration immediately bogged down elsewhere, stalked by claims of Russian collusion and interference during the 2016 campaign. Secret meetings with Kremlin attachés, back-channel promises to lift sanctions, foreknowledge about hacked material, and amplification of fake Facebook pages and fake Twitter feeds and fake Instagram accounts. All of it caught up to Trump almost from the outset of his presidency. When the U.S. Department of Justice tapped Special Counsel Robert Mueller to investigate the Trump campaign's links with Russia and post-Soviet oligarchs, America clung on for a ride into the heart of Russian interference operations and what the American president knew about it all. As Americans waited for the results of Mueller's inquiry, information began leaking that illustrated how the tears in America's anti-kleptocracy fabric had only continued to widen. The leaks and investigative reports pointed to the fact that post-Soviet officials and oligarchs had discovered a pair of new loopholes to exploit and new tools to implement, creating a new pipeline that led them directly into the White House and directly into the control center of America's anti-corruption efforts and American democracy itself. The first loophole dealt with an industry that had exploded in importance and net worth over the past decade: hedge funds and private equity. These private investment funds, which target a range of assets and which bring in investors with far deeper pockets than most, were initially roped into the Patriot Act's anti-money laundering requirements. But because these investment vehicles at the time were relatively small, restricted to things like pension funds and high net worth individuals, the Treasury Department decided to do what it did with the real estate industry. They offered the hedge funds and private equity firms a temporary exemption from such regulations. Again, there's no evidence any of this was malign. Treasury's rationale here was the same as with the real estate sector. It wanted to study how regulations could affect this growing pillar of the American financial sector. But, as with all the other exemptions, by the start of the 2020s, that temporary exemption was nearly 20 years old, during which time the hedge fund and private equity industry had mushroomed into one of the biggest and least regulated financial sectors extant. The entire industry is now an ocean of anonymous wealth, sucking up trillions of dollars from around the world. And in the U.S., private equity and hedge funds can do so with no obligation to check the sources of client wealth, or even figure out who they're offering their anonymous financial services to. These funds are doing the same thing as the Swiss banks, anonymizing money on an industrial scale, wrote investigative journalist Tom Burgess. Already, we've seen substantial sums from Chinese, Russian, and Saudi sources circling among these private, unregulated investment firms. One Wall Street Journal investigation, for instance, found that the Saudi government has been the largest Silicon Valley startup funder since mid-2016, investing at least $11 billion. But thanks to the Treasury Department's temporary exemption, Bloomberg wrote, the U.S. knows shockingly little about the sources of foreign finance flowing through hedge funds and private equity, or about just how much of those industries is propped up by dirty money. With no requirement to disclose even the names of investors or non-voting owners, private equity firms are perfect vehicles for money laundering, anti-corruption expert Sarah Chase wrote in 2020. Private equity funds can shield the identities of all but a very few owners, so they are magnets for questionable money, added Joshua Kirschenbaum, a former Treasury official who's tried to raise the alarm about the threats these investment vehicles now pose to broader anti-kleptocracy efforts. These funds are among the most sophisticated investors and an appealing vehicle for a foreign actor with malign intent. For example, one seeking to interfere in an election, cultivate inappropriate political influence, or engage in complex financial crime. In short, hedge funds and private equity are the latest tools for hiding gobs of illicit wealth, available to anyone looking for a safe haven for their dirty money. The industry's defense, according to those lobbying on its behalf, is that because such funds are largely restricted to deep-pocketed entrepreneurs, and because a multi-year commitment is required before investors can pull their money out, these funds are hardly successful money laundering lures. They essentially ask, if you're trying to launder money, why would you bury it somewhere you can't access for years on end? And there's a decent point buried in that spin. If you're looking for a quick laundering turnaround, these funds are the last place you want to look. Yet that completely misunderstands the appeal of hedge funds and private equity in the first place. After all, the crooked oligarchs attracted to such funds aren't looking for quick laundering turnarounds. They're looking to keep their ill-gotten wealth safe as their kleptocratic nest egg. Billions in dirty money can go in with no questions asked, and all the oligarchs or officials have to do is wait a few years before they can pull the money out, money that's then perfectly clean. Think of it as someone grabbing the control knob of the American money laundering machine and turning it to the long cycle. If you're human trafficking or selling drugs, or if it's a business you're running and you need to get that money back to get more meth or to buy more fentanyl or to pay more coyotes, that money's not going into a hedge fund. Alma Angotti, a former Treasury official who tried to implement anti-money laundering procedures for the industry, told me. But if you're an oligarch stealing oil money and you don't need all of it, you need to keep it somewhere safe. So you put it in a hedge fund or real estate. You want to protect it from your own government as much as ours. It's not a good vehicle for narco traffickers, but it's sure as hell a good vehicle if you're a corrupt public official. In 2020, a leak of internal FBI documents revealed the Bureau's ballooning concerns about the money laundering now swirling the industry. Foreign criminals, foreign oligarchs, and foreign adversaries have begun using hedge funds and private equity firms to launder money, circumventing traditional anti-money laundering programs, the FBI wrote. The Bureau pointed directly to the temporary exemption that allowed transnational money launderers to take advantage. The FBI assumes anti-money laundering programs are not adequately designed to monitor and detect threat actors' use of private investment funds to launder money, the FBI memo continued. Criminally complicit investment fund managers likely will expand their money laundering operations as private placement opportunities increase, resulting in continued infiltration of the licit global financial system. The FBI cited a number of examples of recent infiltration into this sector, with the dirty money mixing and churning alongside things like American pension funds. In January 2019, a Mexican cartel opened a number of new accounts with an American hedge fund, laundering at least $1 million every week. In New York, a private equity firm opened its doors to $100 million in wire transfers from a Russian company connected to Russian organized crime. But it was in Maryland that post-Soviet interference efforts and money laundering via American hedge funds and private equity both came to a head. In 2013, an LLC called ByteGrid sealed a $7.5 million contract with the state in order to manage Maryland's election data, including the oversight of statewide voter registration information and election management systems. At the time, the deal raised no eyebrows. Russian interference in American elections was still a few years off, and few looked at foreign interference, let alone via private equity investments, as a potential concern. But in 2015, ByteGrid was acquired by a private equity company called AltPoint Capital Partners. Again, the move didn't seem to worry anyone. All anyone saw was a private equity firm purchasing a company specializing in computer systems, which just so happened to be overseeing the integrity of Maryland's elections and voter data. What no one in Maryland realized, what no one knew until Maryland officials received a call from the FBI, was that the principal investor in the private equity company wasn't a distant American investor or a pension fund looking for solid returns for its constituents. It was, instead, a Russian oligarch, one intimately close with Putin. Vladimir Potanin, a balding, sullen-faced billionaire, had stood as one of Russia's wealthiest oligarchs for years. Potanin gained notoriety as one of the brains behind the much-maligned privatization scandals of the mid-1990s, which funneled much of Russia's natural resources and industrial treasures directly into oligarchs' pockets. As David Hoffman wrote in his seminal 2001 book on Russian oligarchs, Potanin became a ringleader of all the oligarchs in 1995 in their greatest single property grab, helping create a process that was not open to foreigners, was not transparent, and turned out to be rigged. It also had one profound consequence that they did not foresee. The privatization process was the beginning of a merger between the Russian oligarchs and the government. Officials in Maryland had likely never heard of Potanin, but this oligarch was now secretly bankrolling the private equity firm that oversaw the company tasked with maintaining the integrity, the authenticity, and the efficacy of elections in Maryland, including the election in 2016, in which America experienced a shockwave of foreign interference, the kind of which it had never before seen. As State Senate President Thomas V. Miller said when announcing the discovery, "We felt it imperative that our constituents know that a Russian oligarch has purchased our election machinery." Fortunately, none of Maryland's 2016 votes appeared changed, and there's as yet no indication that Potanin used his anonymous investments to sway American policy. The same can't be said, however, of the financial flows from the roster of post-Soviet oligarchs connected to interference operations into a second and equally wide-open sector, American nonprofits. When you think of nonprofits, maybe you think of a local charity, or perhaps a group like Amnesty International, trying to better communities both near and far. But there's another class of American nonprofits that operates on a more elite, highbrow footing. Institutions like high-profile universities, such as Harvard and the University of Southern California. Cultural icons, such as New York's Museum of Modern Art, MoMA, and the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., entities like prestigious think tanks that act as unofficial centers of policymaking, such as the Brookings Institution and the Council on Foreign Relations. These nonprofits enjoy rarefied status in the U.S., hosting dignitaries, working with legislators to help craft policy, acting as America's font of intellectual and cultural capital, and helping buttress American soft power. In many ways, these institutes and universities and cultural staples are the best of America. But like hedge funds, real estate, or escrow agents before them, they're also not subjected to any anti-money laundering or due diligence procedures. To be sure, money laundering via nonprofits doesn't seem to make much sense. But these nonprofits serve a different purpose for kleptocrats. Given the lack of any oversight or regulation, American nonprofits have effectively left the door wide open for any kleptocrat who'd like to improve their image, to use their dirty money to launder not their money, but their reputations. The phenomenon is known as reputation laundering. An oligarch or a crooked official can offer their dirty money as a donation to these nonprofits. The nonprofits don't transform those funds into clean money, as with real estate or hedge funds. Rather, they transform the donor into a philanthropist, or publish material whitewashing the donor's background, offering them a new, benevolent reputation that helps bury any rumors or suppositions about their corruption, and helps dissuade others from looking too closely into their background. For years, there was little data to back up claims that these American nonprofits had transformed into reputation laundering centers. But as I and a number of anti-corruption colleagues, including those with the Anti-Corruption Data Collective, discovered in 2020, these institutes had not only become reputation laundering factories, but they'd become massive magnets for the same questionable foreign monies already worming through American shell companies, American hedge funds, American real estate, and the like. More concerningly, these nonprofits all gladly accepted tainted funds from the entire range of post-Soviet oligarchs directly connected to foreign interference efforts in the U.S. The numbers we uncovered were staggering. In one of our studies in 2020, we found that donations from the Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs connected to interference investigations totaled anywhere between $372 million and $435 million, all directed to more than 200 of the most prestigious nonprofit institutions in America. Universities like George Washington and Cornell and NYU, cultural institutes like the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Guggenheim, think tanks like the Atlantic Council and the Council on Foreign Relations, all of them recipients of substantial sums from the oligarchs directly connected to foreign interference operations, including some later sanctioned directly by the U.S. for their role in Russia's efforts. Any number of oligarchs have pursued this tactic. Russian oligarch Viktor Vekselberg, who was sanctioned in 2018 by the U.S. for aiding the Kremlin's efforts in Russia's dictatorship, donated substantial amounts to the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a prominent think tank in Washington. The Wilson Center awarded Vekselberg the Woodrow Wilson Award for Public Service for his outstanding contributions to the rebirth of Russian philanthropy. Another oligarch, Viktor Pinchuk, who had previously bankrolled Paul Manafort's work, according to DOJ filings, though the oligarch later denied it, used his Ukraine-based foundation to donate significant sums to prestigious think tanks like the Atlantic Council and Brookings Institution. The Ukrainian oligarch even donated a staggering $10 to $25 million to the Clinton Foundation, including individual gifts of $1 to $5 million in 2012 and between $5 and $10 million in 2013. All of these donations have helped Pinchuk to be seen as a pro-Western figure, escaping the kinds of criticism some of his other oligarchic compatriots have faced. But these figures are nothing compared to a post-Soviet oligarch named Lynn Blavatnik. Despite being worth an estimated tens of billions of dollars, odds are you haven't heard of Blavatnik. However, he's arguably the most successful oligarch to emerge from the entire post-Soviet morass, not least because he managed to obtain American citizenship. Blavatnik made billions in the Russian natural resources industry, working directly alongside a number of now-sanctioned oligarchs like Vekselberg and Oleg Deripaska. After obtaining American citizenship, Blavatnik made his splashiest investment in 2011 when he snapped up Warner Music for $3.3 billion. Still, Blavatnik's hold in the U.S. remained somewhat precarious. As The Hollywood Reporter revealed, the sources of Blavatnik's wealth aren't entirely clear. As such, Blavatnik turned to a familiar playbook, philanthropy. Donations soon burst forth, either from the oligarch or his company, Access Industries, to dozens of American institutes willing to open their doors for him, willing to transform him from a post-Soviet oligarch with an unclear background into a benefactor par excellence. There were the universities, including NYU and USC and Sarah Lawrence, all of which accepted his money. There were the cultural institutions, like New York's Lincoln Center and Carnegie Hall, the latter of which now counts Blavatnik as a trustee. In 2018, Blavatnik outdid himself. His Blavatnik Family Foundation announced a $200 million donation to Harvard Medical School, the largest gift in the school's entire history. Administrators will rename the school's 10 academic departments located on its main campus the Blavatnik Institute at Harvard Medical School, the Harvard Crimson reported. People forgot all about Blavatnik's background, or about his previous work alongside now-sanctioned Russian oligarchs, and began viewing him simply as a philanthropist. For a bit, Blavatnik appeared able to toss his money around wherever he liked. But in 2019, news broke that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's office had specifically investigated Blavatnik's massive donations to Trump's inauguration. Vekselberg, one of the Russian oligarchs sanctioned by the U.S., also claimed that he attended Trump's inauguration party at a table Blavatnik paid for. Blavatnik's spokesperson denied this. Shortly thereafter, with his reputation taking a significant hit, Blavatnik announced a $13 million donation to the Council on Foreign Relations, heretofore considered one of America's more prestigious think tanks, a move that appeared to directly follow the reputation laundering playbook mentioned above. Unlike his previous donations, though, Blavatnik's latest gift was instantly met by a chorus of criticism from the most prominent anti-corruption and anti-kleptocracy voices in the U.S. and elsewhere. In a letter addressed to CFR head Richard Haass, dozens of signatories, including leading experts on post-Soviet kleptocracy and former members of the Treasury Department, State Department, and National Security Council, condemned the CFR's willingness to accept the donation, claiming it was a means of helping Blavatnik export Russian kleptocratic practices to the West. As their letter read, "We regard the donation as another step in the long-standing effort of Mr. Blavatnik, who, as we explained below, has close ties to the Kremlin and its kleptocratic network to launder his image in the West. It is our considered view that Blavatnik uses his philanthropy, funds obtained by and with the consent of the Kremlin at the expense of the state budget and the Russian people, at leading Western academic and cultural institutions to advance his access to political circles. Such philanthropic capital enables the infiltration of the U.S. and U.K. political and economic establishments at the highest levels. It is also a means by which Blavatnik exports Russian kleptocratic practices to the West." Others published similar criticisms. "Blavatnik is entitled to spend his money how he pleases," Anne Marlowe wrote in the New York Times, "but institutions, which at least in principle stand for the ethical pursuit of knowledge, sully themselves by accepting it." One of the few groups to return Blavatnik's attempted donation was the Hudson Institute. Haass claimed the CFR undertook a rigorous review of the funds, as it does with all donations. But Haass stated that the think tank would still be keeping the money nonetheless. Not only that, but Haass proudly announced that the CFR would be renaming their internship program after Blavatnik. And who, after all, could be against financing underpaid interns? Blavatnik's successful CFR donation illustrated that it's frankly open season, Shays, one of the letter's signatory, told me. It broadcast to the Kremlin that if you just disguise your money a little bit, the U.S. system is still fully penetrable. It's that penetrability that brings us directly back to Trump and to the final marriage of American kleptocracy, American power, and the potential end of American democracy. In 2014, prompted by a request from the FBI, Austrian authorities arrested a Ukrainian oligarch named Dmitry Firtash, holding him while he awaited extradition to the U.S. At the time, the arrest sent shudders throughout the oligarchic class, both in Ukraine and beyond. Long viewed as one of the titans of the post-Soviet gas trade, and long associated with the kinds of corrupt, kleptocratic money-moving schemes others like Kolomoisky knew so well, Firtash dodged accusations of high-level corruption by playing the same reputation-laundering games others had long pursued, including wooing former members of the British Parliament and donating millions of pounds to Cambridge University in order to bankroll the university's Ukrainian Studies program. As Cambridge still boasts on its website, Cambridge Ukrainian Studies, an initiative of the Department of Slavonic Studies, was launched at Cambridge with the support of Mr. Firtash in 2008. But by the mid-2010s, Firtash's schemes caught up with him. After the oligarch revealed his ties to Russian mafioso Semyon Mogilevich to an American diplomat, the U.S. Department of Justice accused the oligarch of acting as an upper echelon associate of Russian organized crime. Levying charges of large-scale bribery, the U.S. formally indicted him in 2014. Austrian authorities obliged and placed the stunned oligarch under house arrest. For a few years, Firtash wilted in Vienna. One figure seemed to capture the oligarch's ire more than any other: Joe Biden, then serving as vice president and the U.S.'s point man on pushing anti-corruption reforms in Ukraine. "I was repulsed by Biden's presence in Ukraine," the oligarch would later say, blaming Biden for the successful pro-transparency reforms Ukraine instituted following the 2014 revolution. He was the overlord. Toward the end of the 2010s, however, Firtash still hadn't flown to the U.S. and still hadn't been forced to face the charges the DOJ had leveled against him. And by then, a new administration was running the show in Washington. A new administration dismantling America's anti-kleptocracy policies, one decision at a time. A new administration launched into the White House by one of Firtash's old business partners, Paul Manafort, whom Firtash had worked with during Manafort's time in Ukraine. A new administration that, via a network of far-right lawyers and frumpy, cartoonish bagmen, had begun rummaging around for dirt on the figure Trump thought posed the greatest threat to his 2020 campaign, Biden. It was a new administration that, as Firtash saw it, presented an opportunity. In 2019, Firtash dumped his previous legal team, composed of white-collar Washington insiders. He replaced them with a pair of conspiratorial, hard-right lawyers named Victoria Tensing and Joe DeGeneva. He also hired someone he described as a translator, a dowdy Ukrainian-American named Lev Parnas, who claimed to know both Trump and Trump's befuddled lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. In addition to the money he used to pay Tensing and DeGeneva, Firtash shelled out hundreds of thousands of dollars directly to Parnas, including funds for private jets and trips to Vienna, transforming Parnas into, as he said, the best-paid interpreter in the world. Shortly after Firtash hired the triumvirate, Americans began learning all about how dirty post-Soviet money had upended American politics. They learned about Trump's attempts to shake down the Ukrainian government for dirt on Biden, the first time a president had ever strong-armed a foreign government in order to fabricate smears against a political rival. Americans also began learning about all of Giuliani's unregistered work on behalf of shady foreign clients, from Ukraine to Venezuela to Turkey, and his ties to a raft of disgraced Ukrainian officials suddenly spinning lies about Biden's work. Americans further learned that Parnas had secretly funneled suspect post-Soviet monies into the U.S. via an anonymous Delaware shell company, part of the hundreds of millions of dollars Moscow and Beijing have expended to interfere in democratic processes abroad, as the German Marshall Fund's Josh Rudolph and Thomas Morley uncovered in 2020. At the center of all these revelations stood one figure, Firtash, the Ukrainian kleptocrat, whispering in the ears of the pro-Trump figures he'd surrounded himself with, bankrolling their efforts, serving as the apparent broker between Giuliani's team and those in Ukraine trying to help Trump's shakedown, acting as a black hole of dirty money around which all the efforts spun. Giuliani's position on Firtash suddenly changed when the oligarch became useful to Giuliani, Ukrainian journalist Sergei Leshenko wrote. And now his friends are working for Firtash's lawyers, and Giuliani himself uses evidence created by Firtash in his plot to defend Trump. It wasn't difficult to see what Firtash wanted out of the entire affair. As Parnas later revealed, he'd told the oligarch that there were certain ways to get the American extradition request lifted. Perhaps most importantly, helping Trump's broader efforts in Ukraine. Lo and behold, soon after he hired his new legal team, Firtash's pro-Trump lawyers received a sit-down with Attorney General Bill Barr to discuss their client's status, a remarkable development, given that Barr was supposed to be charged with overseeing Firtash's extradition. Thanks in large part to Trump's rank incompetence, the entire pressure campaign against Ukraine eventually imploded, resulting in Trump's first impeachment. But save for a concerned whistleblower who revealed Trump's campaign and began the wheels of impeachment spinning, Firtash could have succeeded, not only in getting the extradition request lifted, but in creating an entirely new mode of how kleptocrats can influence a susceptible, mercenary White House, directly upending American anti-corruption and anti-kleptocracy efforts in the process. The playbook Firtash created was simple. If you're a kleptocrat who ends up in trouble for money laundering-related crimes, you should hire pro-administration figures and claim to have knowledge of dirt on a political opponent, regardless of the accuracy of the information. You should then pledge to trade information and set up meetings in return for the White House lifting American investigations and American charges. And if you succeed, you can promptly return to the world of transnational money laundering these oligarchs know well. It was something completely unprecedented in American history, and it nearly worked. Some call it strategic corruption, or the emergence of the strategic usage of corrupt actors to subvert democratic governments and democracy writ large. More colloquially, you can just name it after the kleptocrat who perfected it. Just call it the Firtash model. This model is now open and available to any kleptocrats facing American investigations, regardless of the scope of their crimes. Other kleptocrats facing American charges swiftly tried the same playbook, or at least pieces of it. Mikolaj Lozhevsky, a Ukrainian oligarch connected to the gas trade, allegedly offered Giuliani derogatory information on Trump's political opponents if Giuliani could help the oligarch curry favor with the Justice Department. Zhou Lo, the Malaysian kleptocrat who convinced Britney Spears to pretzel herself inside a birthday cake, and who ended up ironically bankrolling the production of The Wolf of Wall Street, a film about white-collar criminals with looted monies, secretly funneled money to GOP fundraiser Elliot Broidy in order to lobby Trump. But if there's one oligarch who embodied the Firtash model best, it was Kolomoisky, effectively completing the loop of American kleptocracy writ large and bringing it all to its final, obvious conclusion. Hunkered in Kyiv in early 2019, Kolomoisky had watched his hopes of wringing concessions out of Zelensky go up in smoke, and he sensed the walls closing in. By 2019, the FBI had learned where he had stashed his ill-gotten gains in the U.S., in places like Cleveland and Illinois and Kentucky. Meanwhile, lawsuits filed against him in the U.S. and elsewhere continued to accumulate. The schlubby oligarch-turned-warlord flailed for a response, watching his windows of opportunity quickly closing. But Kolomoisky knew Firtash, and he watched the latter's maneuvers closely. He saw the fellow oligarch, also subjected to American investigations, hire a pair of lawyers firmly in Trump's camp, and watched them get an extraordinary sit-down with the American Attorney General. He watched him toss millions at others in Trump's immediate orbit. He watched a spool of clearly fabricated stories about Biden suddenly spin out, cascading around the White House, with Firtash sitting at the middle of the entire operation, an oligarchic spider at the center of a web of lies and payments. And he watched, just like the rest of us, this new Firtash model play out in real time. And maybe, he thought, he could use it for his own ends. First, in November 2019, Kolomoisky hired one of Trump's longtime lawyers, Mark Kasowitz, a bulldog attorney who'd worked as part of Trump's team during the Mueller investigation. He also hired a second American lawyer, Bud Cummins, who'd pushed pro-Trump rhetoric regarding Ukraine before. Alongside these two, he reportedly hired a Ukrainian national named Andriy Telyshenko, who'd joined Firtash's lawyers in helping spread anti-Biden conspiracies among American right-wing propaganda outlets. Kolomoisky then dove headfirst into the fertile ground of conspiracy theories that the White House and its defenders had gleefully promulgated. When Giuliani visited Ukraine in December, scouring for more dirt on Biden, he met with an oafish former Ukrainian official named Kostyantin Kulik, a figure who just so happened to work at Kolomoisky's behest as the oligarch's secret weapon. Kulik claimed to have damaging information on Biden. Giuliani also had a sit-down meeting with Oleksandr Dubinsky, another malignant official who headed Kolomoisky's influence group in Kyiv, according to one Ukrainian journalist. By late 2019, Kolomoisky spread the word. He had the dirt Trump wanted, and he didn't care how it got to the White House. The oligarch began claiming to have damaging information on the Bidens, Politico reported, including on both Joe and his son Hunter. As one attorney familiar with his efforts said, the oligarch used the promise of scandalous intel to keep himself relevant to the whole Biden dirt discussion, and he would also like to ingratiate himself to Trump. The oligarch played coy. He didn't want to trumpet his Biden-related claims to the world, just to the president and his bagmen. He's been kind of cryptic and cute about it, the lawyer continued. But as one Western diplomat said, Kolomoisky was clearly trying to become friends with Trump and Giuliani. The signs, as with Firtash, were unmistakable. As Volodymyr Vysenko, a Kiev-based political analyst, told Talking Points Memo, Kolomoisky seems to be trying the same thing as Firtash. He was trying out the Firtash model, with an American administration more than willing to play along. And the oligarch had one demand: make his issues, all these lawsuits and inquiries, go away. Kill the investigations in both the U.S. and Ukraine. And let the kleptocratic carousel continue, as it ever had. Our oligarchs think that if you befriend the main person in a country, then that will solve all your problems, Vysenko continued. With a president like Trump, what oligarch would think otherwise? By 2020, Kolomoisky had become the logical endpoint for America's collapse into the global center of modern kleptocracy. He was a man who spent years taking full advantage of American anti-money laundering loopholes, allegedly piling untold millions into American real estate with little more than a desire to obscure his jaw-dropping dirty money operations. And now, as investigators began uncovering his network, he turned to an American president to get his investigations and his charges lifted, with the promise of unfounded dirt against a political rival in return. Through Kolomoisky, the marriage of kleptocracy and foreign interference in the era of Trump had been consummated. But the oligarch misjudged the timing. By the time he'd started using this Firtash model for his own ends, it was already too late. Too many others were already on the hunt for other kleptocrats trying the same strategy. And America, despite Trump's best efforts otherwise, remained a functioning democracy, with pressure from Congress and the broader body politic keeping the heat on the administration. There were too many eyeballs watching what Giuliani and his cronies were doing on the president's behalf. Kolomoisky's efforts, like Firtash's before him, eventually splintered, undone by American democracy. But he, like Firtash, nearly succeeded. And if he had, that American kleptocratic circle of using American financial anonymity to hide gargantuan money laundering operations and then using the proceeds of such operations to convince an American president to end any investigations and lift any charges, allowing the money laundering operations to run on in perpetuity, would have stood complete. The oligarchs, those who'd looked to the U.S. for years for their dirty money needs, would have won.